Tonight we're going to explore a little bit some of the aspects of what is probably the most dramatic technology emergent in our times and the one that's likely to dominate certainly the coming several decades. Biotechnology. And it's not new, but it's certainly emerging into a whole new phase. The biotech revolution is what we're all about. We're suggesting the possibility it might be the new Sorcerer's Apprentice. But before we get into all that, where are we going and why? What are we all about? Well, first of all, there are some astonishing advances in molecular biology that's going to affect every one of us. Every one of us in this room are going to be touched. Here, one of the major technical journals is pointing out, saying that someone will clone a human within the next 12 months. We also see it in even our household news media. Time magazine's cover, Drugs of the Future, the amazing new medicines will be based on DNA. And there is going to be, the good news is there's some long-sought remedies for many of mankind's most elusive diseases are right on the horizon here. On the flip side, there's also some very serious concerns, especially those that are informed. And we see the growing of a human ear on a rat, and we wonder, that's grotesque enough to get our attention. What's going on? There's also some biblically relevant aspects to all of this on our horizon. So our agenda is in two parts. The first is looking at biotechnology as a panacea. What are the opportunities? What are the issues? And what are the tissues? And we'll talk about the cell, which is the center of all of this, and the code of life, and then stem cells. What are they, and so forth? And the second part of our program will deal with the possibilities on the dark side. Is this really a Pandora's box? And we'll talk about genetically manipulated foods. We'll talk about tampering with the engines of creation, the human genome. And we'll talk about some of the issues of concern and also touch on some of the possible prophetic implications or conjectures. But first of all, let's focus on the opportunities. And one of the things is I'll go through these relatively quickly to give you a flavor of what's going on. But be sensitive to the fact that it's international. This is not something that's just here in the United States. We tend to dominate so many technologies. This is one that's everywhere. Hemophiliacs, people who have a hemophiliac problem. There's a genetically engineered protein now from out of Munich, Germany, that is offering a new hope for people with that affliction. Arterial pulmonary hypertension. Endothelium is a single cell layer that lines the veins and arteries, and it plays a key role in the onset of arterial pulmonary hypertension by secreting a hormone that constricts blood vessels. And there's a Swiss biotech firm, Actelon, that is developing a receptor antagonist called Bosutan, which should be available this year. Brain trauma. Now, this is a strange one because there are about 10 million cases per year worldwide, and there's no good way to stop a freshly injured brain cells from killing surrounding healthy brain cells. And so Israeli scientists have developed a cannabis-derived drug. I know none of you would know what cannabis is, but I'll go on. Dexamethasone, which appears to inhibit the action of these neurotoxic chemicals, which drastically limits the brain damage. See, many people will have brain damage in an accident. They'll get to the hospital and be fine. And it's hours later that the brain, they start having serious problems. So if this is administered within 6 hours, it can deal with that. Breast cancer. In Brazil, they're researching a parasite that makes its home in freshwater snail in the hopes that this will provide a cure for breast cancer, strangely enough. Chasing diabetes. This afflicts so many people. About 20 million in India are expected to suffer from some form of diabetes by the end of the decade. India is a great place to do genetic research because their families tend to stay put for generations. They don't marry very far out of the family circles. And they have the same eating habits for generations. So it turns out to be the kind of environment that gives the useful data to scientists. They've identified four genes. The researchers call them thrifty genes because they're thought to have been useful in days of famine, adjusting the body metabolism to less food. But with food relatively plentiful, the gene tends to interfere with the normal body's ability to control blood sugar levels. And they think that may be a key. So They're spending $3 million a year on research. To triple its team of 150 biotech researchers to learn how to turn this gene off. A drug for several of us that are great interested in the drug for obesity. One child in 10 suffers from obesity. And a French firm, Gnesset, has developed a drug, Famoxin, which speeds up the metabolism, burn off fat. Now, don't jump on this one. You have to have an injection once a month, and it's still in clinical trials. But they started out developing techniques for gene sequencing and other basic research, and wound up discovering several genes having to do with prostate cancer. So these things are not, to a layman, don't sound like they're related, but they turn out to be. Better rice. This is another project. 200 labs across Japan are busy decoding the rice genome in the hope of making a super rice, something that's genetically modified that could withstand chilly temperatures, drought, and resist disease. We'll talk a little bit more about genetically altered foods here shortly. But in Japan, the Japanese government has formed a 10-nation consortium that aims to sequence the entire rice gene by the year 2004. Now, Japan doesn't need rice, but they are hoping that this research will provide breakthroughs that will affect corn, wheat, and others have similar genes. Then they're fishing for new genes. 95% of human genes are found in the zebra fish. It's a tiny little striped fish originally from the River Ganges. They're handy to work with because they're transparent. You can watch the embryos. They're easy to monitor. They breed in very large numbers, and they can treat them with a chemical that causes genetic mutations. They deliberately introduce mutations and then link the gene, find out which genes were altered, provide that mutation. So it's a way of dealing it. They hope to take these genetic defects and then work backwards to the gene that affects the mutation. And there's a company in Germany, Artemis Pharmaceuticals, that have undertaken the largest study of zebrafish. They expect to have bred 17 million of these, mutating every gene is the goal. And they hope to, they're looking for a drug to prevent angiogenesis, and that is the growth of new blood vessels in cancerous tumors, trying to restrict the growth of tumors. This whole area, though, is a global growth area, is the point that I'm trying to get across here. We generally dominate technology in the United States. We have more than 1,300 biotech firms in the United States compared to 700 in Europe. But the international competition is fierce. This is all going to impact something I'm going to come up later, but I want to set the background here. Britain has a lead here because back in the 80s, they had the outbreak of what's called mad cow disease. That's a brain rotting. It's a bovine spongiform encephalopathies, and it's the human form of that is Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. But it's a terrifying thing. Europe, even today, is finding new fresh outbreaks of this, and they're in panic. But now it's our turn, because just recent reports, they're fearing that some of this has even gotten to the United States somehow. But anyway, with that early start in focusing on biotech, Britain now has 560 biotech companies, 50% of the 70 publicly traded European biotech firms are in Britain. And the grandfather of all of these is Celltech. They pioneered the drugs that exploit the body's own antibodies to fight disease. But even this company, which is the leader, just posted a profit for the first time this year. So these are all quite speculative ventures. And Britain has approved its first three biotech products this year, some anesthetics, something for migraines, and a treatment for Alzheimer's disease. But this year, just recently, Britain has now made human cloning legal, which is quite a shock, because they've been very conservative, but they've just passed that and for research purposes. But there's a lot of uproar starting because they feel it's the beginning of human clones. And in the Netherlands, they have a firm that's the leading manufacturer of purifying genetic material, such as proteins and nucleic acids. And its products are used by most labs all throughout the world. In Sweden, there's a firm called ProSequencing, which has become the technological leader in making systems for automated DNA analysis. This turns out to be the main workhorse behind most of these projects, is to understand the sequencing of DNA, and it's a laborious data processing headache, and this is a leading firm. And so their products are well known within the field. And now, optimism in this general area is reflected by hundreds of small companies that are emerging all over Scandinavia, Southern Europe, elsewhere. Now we can turn to the large classical drug firms, the pharmaceutical firms. I might mention, by the word, in your Bible, the word sorcery is actually the English translation for the word pharmakia in the Greek. So when we speak of pharmaceutical firms, I suppose the King James translators would call them sorcery firms, but probably some good cause. In any case, these firms have expiring patents and very thin product lines. It's very, very expensive to build a new drug, like about $500 million, and typically more than 10, 15 years' worth of work. Now, the new drug discovery techniques are making that less expensive, down to maybe $200 million, less than half, and faster in almost half the time. And they're also more accurate, more targetable, which is all helpful, which means that markets have become more segmented, but that also means that smaller laboratories are becoming viable because they can pick a niche and work it, and that's their ambition. And so one of the examples of this is Weilig Biotechnology in Munich. They're working on methods to stop a particular protein that causes cancer to spread. This is active only in less than 30% of cancer victims, but that's a market still. It's 100, 200 million a year, which is large enough to support a company so if they focus and lead it. So public markets for these companies, of course, have been limited outside the United States because venture capitalists usually need an exit, which means they need to have some way of getting out of it when the time comes, which you need a public market. Well, in the last 3 years, Germany, France, and Italy and other countries have set up NASDAQ-like markets for the high-tech companies. And that gives them necessary liquidity. It also gives them the opportunity with stock options to lure back the scientists that have evacuated coming to the United States. And so European venture capital is a big thing these days. Over half a billion euros in 1999, less than half out of the U.S., but up 53% over the year before. So it's growing. And their leading biotech entrepreneur, Chris Evans, has founded 17 science-based companies in Britain. He's also launched some mutual funds in this area. Now, Germany has embraced biotech as the key to its, as a country, long-term competitiveness. In 1993, they passed legislation designed to streamline the decision-making. They held a biotech contest among 17 regions. In 1995, they awarded 50 million marks each to Munich, the Rhineland near Cologne, and the area including Heidelberg to help build research centers. And they hope to spend over 1.2 billion marks over the next 5 years to human genome research at universities and institutes. The law was also adjusted to give scientists and universities at universities and institutes the rights to their intellectual property should they decide to leave for startups. And last year, the German researchers claimed 14% of all biotech patent applications. That's up from 10% a year, 5 years ago. There are more than 400 biotech-related startups pepper the country. Now, this will give you a quick, more than just a business profile. What we're trying to do is point out the environment here is very diverse. Small companies all over intensely competing. France, the French government has increased its funding of biotech research 10 times since a decade ago. And Genopole is a research campus near Évry, which is near Paris. It's known as Genetic Valley. Just like we have a Silicon Valley, they have a whole series of companies that are focusing in this area. And they hope to have 50 or 60 companies launched within the next next 2 years. And there are other Genopoles slated for 20 other French cities. So they're really going after this with a vengeance. In Spain, we have they also are investigating potential cancer anti-cancer agents extracted from marine plants and animals. And the firm holds 620 patents. And the great hope is for ET743, as they call it. It's an anti-tumor agent extracted from Red Sea squirts that live in the Caribbean and Mediterranean seas. And it's been tested on 750 patients in the U.S. and Europe and shows few of the typical side effects. It expects to be licensed in Europe within another couple of years to treat bone, skin, breast, and ovarian and other cancers. And then, of course, Israel. They sowed the seeds of their own biotech boom back in the 50s and 60s around citrus crops. In 1980, the father of Israel's biotech industry, Chaim Aviv, has managed to attract American venture capitalists, and his success has encouraged European investors also. So there's been a whole bunch of small startups in Israel also. They now have 135 biotech companies in this little country called Israel. India, as I mentioned, is a major player. They encouraged a biotech industry in 1986, establishing a separate government department charged with increasing the number of biotech grads from universities. Now 50 universities produce about 500 biotech scientists annually. And so we can expect a lot of this more and more going on. And they're funding 50 centers around the country to connect genomic data. And of course, as I indicated before, you know, their caste system, their isolated and inbred tribes are particularly well preserved. And this is a great database for information to the scientists. And so, and hopefully ultimately providing cures. And Brazil is also launching biotech research. A São Paulo-based science foundation has jump-started an operation that has over 200 scientists at 62 laboratories. And Brazilian researchers are lead in sequencing cancers. Last year, they completed 1 million sequences. In year 2002, they hope to have a complete genetic map of breast cancer tumor. Well, Japan has got a late start. Government plans back in 1981 for an automated high-speed DNA sequencing facility floundered due to turf wars and bickering among the scientists. And so despite the hard times, the government still plans to increase spending on biotech research by 23% this coming year. And they've opened a genomic sciences center in Yokohama, funding a nuclear magnetic resonance center to study protein structures. And they're also building a center that the largest of its kind in Asia, in Kyoto. So while all this is going on, all this gives you a quick flavor that we're dealing here not with just a little breakthrough here and there. We're talking about a major tide within the science community. And yet storm clouds are starting to gather. Now, as we watch all this, obviously there's going to be a lot of action, both up and down in this world, in the financial world. There'll be many false starts, a lot of belly-up failures, a lot of consolidations, especially among the giants, cross-alliances, multilingual labs, talent raids, international funding, all that sort of thing, with all the hopes and with the disappointments. But there's also, quite apart from the financial ups and downs, which characterize any new boom, there are other implications of all of this. See, instead of research being done in large government laboratories with procedures and controls, we're talking about small operations all over the world, all in a hurry, not stopping to worry about safeguards, at least certainly not adequate safeguards, dealing with technologies that are unpredictable in their outcome. And that's part of the why this background is a little terrifying. See, when you talk about nuclear weapons, that takes a lot of money and specialization. If you talk about other kinds of biological research in large laboratories, pharmaceutical companies or government, their procedures and history and safeguards. This isn't like that. These are garage shops. It doesn't take a lot of capital to get in this. So that's why we're using the term sorcerer's apprentice. You may know that Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, back in just before the close of the 18th century, wrote a The Magic Student, Der Zauberlehrer. And this was turned into a symphony by Paul Dukas in 1897 called The Sorcerer's Apprentice. And, of course, all of us have probably seen it when Walt Disney featured it in his Fantasia in 1940. And you may recall it's basically a sorcerer's apprentice in the myth casts a spell but didn't get it quite right. And he wanted to have the brooms do a sweeping for him and collect the water that he was supposed to. Well, he unleashed forces that proved uncontrollable. And even when the brooms had filled the tank, they didn't stop. They kept filling the tank. And he tried to stop it, took an axe to chop it up, and they just multiplied. And it was all going out of control until finally the sorcerer himself wakes up, intervenes, and casts a spell to stop it. And little Mickey Mouse gets swat with a broom in the thing. And so it's just a musical piece. But it's based on this colorful story by von Goethe. And but it's interesting model, because here we have a student spell not quite correct that unleashed forces which proved uncontrollable. And in this case, his master, his teacher, had to intervene to terminate the impending disaster. And there are some that conjecture that may be exactly what we're heading into. Because the Bible does tell us that unless those days be shortened, no flesh would be saved. It could be referring to many different things. But clearly, as we watch the kinds of things that might be unleashed here, it does give us an end-time atmosphere. Now, we're going to explore a little bit our roadmap to physical reality. We're going to be penetrating the very foundations of what we think we understand. Most of us have some glimpse of our human body, have some understanding what it's made up of. It certainly consists of organs. Those organs are made up of tissues. Those tissues are made up of cells. The cells turn out to be much more complex than anyone ever anticipated. With all due deference to Darwin, he had no concept of what a simple cell was. A simple cell is far more complicated than we can imagine. We'll look at it. It's composed of molecular robots, which in turn are composed of a basic atomic structure, And they, of course, are built subatomic particles. And we now know that even those particles are at the end of our limits of perception, that the particles themselves, below them, they have no reality, no locality. We'll talk, just touch on that. The main point, the key to all of this, from our point of view, we're going to focus a little bit on the cells and the molecular robots, because that's going to determine what the real future of this technology and our understanding of them. So we're going to focus a little bit on the cell. And I like to call it a constellation of miracles. It is absolutely, the more we learn about it, the more astonishing it becomes. It's actually a miniature city. Michael Denton highlighted this back in 1986, where he said, although the tiniest bacterial cells are incredibly small, each is in effect a veritable microminiaturized factory. And that's an understatement. Containing thousands of exquisitely designed pieces of intricate molecular machinery made up of 100 billion atoms, far more complicated than any machine built by a man and absolutely without parallel in the non-living world. That's a good summary. The simple cell, we always read about that in our biology books. We talk a simple cell, that's a non sequitur. Let's take the simple cell. We'll discover that it's unparalleled in its complexity and in its own adaptive design. It has a central memory bank, a control station. It is filled with assembly plants and processing units and repackaging and shipping centers. There are robots, automated robots, doing all the work, protein molecules. Each one can consist of like 3,000 atoms in three-dimensional configurations. There are hundreds of thousands of different kinds. It's not just a few dozen. There are hundreds of thousands of different kinds of robots populating this miniature city, doing the work. They have an elaborate communication systems. They have quality control procedures and repair mechanisms, all built in. Staggering when you analyze it. Let's assume we're going to build a model of this. Let's just imagine a school project. We're going to build a model of a simple cell. Obviously, can't see it, so small. We'll multiply it by 1,000 million times larger. That would make each atom about the size of a tennis ball. Just imagine that in your mind. Well, that means you're going to need 10 million million atoms, 10 to the 13th atoms. By the way, if you're just going to count those at one per minute, it'll take you 19 million years to do that. That's a bunch, okay? If you made this model, it would have to be over 10 miles in diameter. Now, the cell itself is circled by a plasma membrane, quick to say, but it actually includes sophisticated gateways and communication receptors to pass or block various materials, also to receive and send certain kinds of signals. So it in itself is sophisticated. The cytoplasm is just what we call the rest of it inside. But then we have the nucleus. This is going to be the key to a lot of our discussion here. It's the information center. It contains, among other things, the master library, the recipe for all of this stuff. And it has a nucleus of its own, so to speak, the nucleolus, which is filled with automated factories and product manufacturing going on there. Then all through this little city, you have power stations, power plants. And then you have what they call the Golgi apparatus. It does the processing, repackaging, shipping. It prepares things for export outside the cell. It's manufactured in the cell. And then you have all kinds of vesicles, which are for storage, for transport, for trash disposal, all kinds of purposes. And this diagram, of course, just an oversimplification to be able to maybe in our mind's eye at least visualize it. But within the cell, you have robot machines, hundreds of thousands of types. You have artificial languages and decoding systems, memory banks for information storage. That is extremely profound because that cannot evolve. That has to be designed. I'll explain that in a minute. Has elegant control systems for regulating the automated assembly of components, prefab modular construction techniques. They even have error fail-safe techniques and proofreading devices for quality control. Can you believe it? Now, the reason I'm so fascinated with this, I guess, is I spent 6 years as a senior executive at Ford Motor Company. And at Ford, we were very proud of one of our unusual plants, well known throughout the world. It's the Ford River Rouge plant, the River Rouge through Detroit. It's very famous because it's the largest integrated manufacturing facility in the world. In one end goes raw limestone, iron ore, coal, and such, in one end. Inside the plant, under this roof, which includes, by the way, about 97 miles of railroad, it manufactures its own steel, it manufactures its own glass, it manufactures its own paint, it has an automated engine facility that manufactures all the different engines automatically, it's hardly any employees in that, it's all automated. Then you have the assembly line, which everybody likes to visit because it's dramatic to watch, where you have the automated assembly of models with, of course, a lot of human labor involved there. But it's mixed models, colors, and so on. And then the point is, raw materials go in one end. They make new cars come out the other end about every 58 seconds when I was there. It's probably a little faster now. Let's hope so anyway. What's interesting is the cell is more complicated than the River Rouge plant at Ford. And the cell can do something the River Rouge plant wouldn't dream of doing or even try to do. The cell is capable of replicating its entire structure within a matter of a few hours. It's interesting to realize that all cells on the planet Earth, plant, animal, whatever, have all come from a previous cell. They've never seen a new cell made. All cells come by division of previous cells. That's kind of interesting. I think it's useful to insert here what I like to call the choreography of the chromosomes. The cell does many, many interesting things, but the most profound is when, for reasons we're not sure why, all the normal processes cease and a whole new ballet takes place. And it's in about four phases. It's called mitosis. This is the splitting of the nucleus of the cell. The cell splitting is called cytokinesis, but the mitosis is the splitting of the nucleus itself. You see there the blue and red thing. Those are the chromosomes when they're condensed. I'll show you what they look like when they're uncondensed. But they're condensed here, and they've duplicated themselves. Each one's in a pair. But suddenly, the nucleus will disappear. These strange spindles, the mitotic spindles, form, and they go about, you enter what they call the next phase, metaphase. These spindles then somehow attract the chromosomes, and a ballet starts. Some of the spindles are designed to keep things apart. How the molecules know to form these tubes, and how these tubes form the mitotic spindle, and how this whole ballet gets orchestrated is frankly a mystery. They observe it, they give it fancy names, but they have no, how each spindle knows exactly where to go is part of the riddle. Now, this is just the beginning. Now, when they're all aligned around what you might call the equator of the process, you get in the last two phases, the anaphase and the telophase, and what happens here is the spindle pulls apart the pairing, so now you have duplicates. Prior to this process, the chromosomes have prepared themselves by duplicating. I'll show you that in another approach. But they're separated. As the mitotic spindle pulls them apart, it's done its job. New nuclei will form around each group, and then microfilaments will begin to pinch off the cell itself into two parts, and your cytokinesis will be completed. And you now have two cells. The complexity within the cell is compounded by the fact that it's organized so as to replicate itself without error. Now, obviously, there are errors from time to time. We call that cancer. But when there's a regulatory screw-up of some kind. But there you've just seen two cities duplicate themselves. Typically, it may take an hour within a 24-hour period dedicated to this. Most of the 24-hour cycle would be doing other things, manufacturing things, correcting things, repairing things. But typically, once in each cycle, they will go through this ballet to split. Now, one of the things about the DNA, you always hear about the DNA, our DNA, the actual DNA in your cells is about 6 feet long. I want you to think about this. We can't think of terms as small as DNA, so let's expand it, where the DNA would be represented by monofilament fishing line. And let's take a pair of lines to represent the double helix. That's 125 miles long. How would you arrange that to fold up inside something the size of a basketball in such a way that very frequently you can go in there and read it like with a tape recorder, and put it back without tangling? It's equivalent to two strands of monofilament line, 120 miles long, stored inside a basketball. It's unzipped, copied, and restored on spools. And by the way, all this happens around the spools at three times the speed of an airplane propeller, about 8,000 RPM. All this without tangling. Well, here are the chromosomes. As you unravel those, you then get the condensed chromatin and then the looped domain. And as you unravel that, you finally get into the stream of spools, packed nucleosomes, or histones sometimes called, two turns around each one with a peg, and then these are arranged so that they cluster. And as you unravel those, you finally get down to the famous DNA, double helix of the DNA. So that's what you're dealing with. And the DNA contains the information that produces all the robots, all the robotic machines in the city, in this we call a cell, as well as all the other characteristics that cause the cell to become a tissue, the tissues become organs, the organs become a person. All are coded in here. This is a computer representation. The double helix just binds it together. The key codes are these links between the two helixes. They're always in pairs. For a particular code, you always have a complement with it. I'll show you that in a minute. It's interesting, though, before we go forward, to realize that the DNA is a digital code. And that's exactly what Genesis chapter 1 highlights to us, where God made the beast of the earth after his kind, the cattle after their kind, and everything that creepeth upon the earth after his kind. And God saw that was good. That's a hint right there that these things are digitally defined. There really isn't a continuum. Now, the ultimate technology, let's not confuse ourselves with the chemistry or the physics of all this. The ultimate technology are the thoughts that are expressed in language. Don't confuse the technology of the content with the technology of conveyance. I'll give you an example of what I mean. Think of the manuscript, not the media. You see? Did the ink write the book? You know, you could study books, the different kinds of paper, different kinds of inks. That's great. It tells you nothing about what the book contains as information. The information is the key. So the fact you have these molecules and things, the key, the baffling thing, is the way it's organized. Of course, the code of the DNA, of life, the DNA, of course, was discovered in 1953 by Watson and Crick, a famous milestone. And then the big news last year was they mapped, for the first time, the human genome. But it's my opinion they've just scratched the surface, because that's just the first level of code. They haven't discovered yet that it's multi-level. I think they will. There's about 3.1 billion letters. That's a lot of information. And yet it seems scanty compared to what it actually contains in terms of information, in terms of totally defining all the machines in all the cells in the human body. Now, we did map it last year, thanks to a competition between Ventnor in the private sector and Collins in the government consortium. And of course, we are expecting, everybody's expecting, a gold mine of medical breakthroughs out of all this. It was completed because of the intense competition 5 years ahead of schedule. But its primary challenge is in the information sciences, not in chemistry in the usual sense and that sort of thing. It's the coding of it that's the challenge. Not the only challenge, but the main one. And so to understand language, there is semantics. That's the meaning of the symbols themselves. And I always like to use the simplest message ever sent, probably, that's Paul Revere's ride. Looking at the Old North Church, it would be one if by land, two if by sea. It's a one bit of communication. There's two lanterns, but the one lantern is just a carrier bit. It just tells you the guy didn't fall off the ladder getting up to the thing, you see. And now the syntax, it had to be in a particular place. Having a lantern over there on that other side of the lake, river was not the point. It had to be in the Old North Church. That was the code. The point I want to make is the most advanced computer, if the British had most advanced Cray computers, they could not have broken that code. Because it's strictly by prearrangement. And so did it happen by random accident, or was it contrived by prearrangement? Obviously. It was prearranged. It's simple code, but it was designed. That's the point. And there are simple alphabets, we're all familiar with those, but you may not realize there are such things as error detecting codes. You can make codes that will sense that in the transmission something's been lost. We call them in the simplest form in the computer words a parity bit. You take 7 bits, add 1 to it to get 8 bits to represent a typewriter stroke. But one of those bits just is a check bit to let you know if a bit's dropped. It helps reduce error. It may surprise many people don't realize there's error correcting code. You can add a few more parity bits in the right way, which will tell you not only that there's an error, but where the error occurred. And if it's binary, you can reverse it. So the code can be error correcting. There's actually been computers built that way in the military, error correcting codes. And there's also adaptive codes that
change their meaning depending on the context or the syntax. What's interesting, the most advanced of these codes is what we're finding in the DNA. Codes that are more advanced in their design than most people who design codes would be sensitive to. The basic building blocks of everything we're talking about are amino acids. And there are hundreds of different amino acids known, but only 20 are utilized by living systems in the construction of proteins. The same 20 are used for all kinds of life. It's interesting, when you have a molecule that's asymmetric, it can be left-handed or right-handed. They speak of chirality. I won't go through the mechanics of it, except to point out that there are left-handed and right-handed geometrical structures. All amino acids are left-handed. Right-handed amino acids are lethal. I always love this. People say, well, if you had enough monkeys typing a typewriter, they'd eventually come up with Shakespeare's plays or something. How long would the monkeys survive if every other key on the typewriter was fatal to the monkey? See, the fact that they're all left-handed implies they could not have derived by accident alone. It's again an evidence of design. Now, most proteins are a sentence, a sequence of between 100 to maybe over 500 of these amino acids. So sequencing the amino acids determines what its future is. The amino acids themselves are fairly complex hydrocarbon molecules. It's not important except that they're designed to link together. Here are the 20 amino acids, not important except to note that half of them, 10 of the 20, are hydrophobic, that's non-soluble, and they're non-polar. These tend to avoid water, so they'll end up becoming in the inside of this machine that's going to end up. And the other 10 are hydrophilic or soluble, and three of them are basic. They have a positive charge. Two of them have a negative charge. The others are neutral. So by this combination of solubility and combination of its intrinsic charge, when these things are sequenced in some kind of chain, that chain will tend to fold up into a three-dimensional machine. And even knowing what we know, we can't predict how it's going to fold up. But it'll always fold up a particular way, which is the thermodynamic least effort combination. But out of a sequencing of this alphabet of 20 amino acids, you can define any of hundreds of thousands of robots that operate within the cell. To select 20, you have an alphabet of 4. Nucleic acids. The important part is to understand that they're in pairs. The adenine code will always have a thymine with it. I'll show you what happens here when this thing replicates. Each one of these 4 codes can be used independently, but it'll always be matched by its complement on the other side. So if we set up a code of letters, their complement will also intrinsically form. And that way, when we split it, and complements join the split, it intrinsically duplicates itself. By splitting it, the missing alphabets will flow in there to complete the code that you've defined. You define the code arbitrarily, that's fine, but the complement will join to make it intrinsically self-replicating. That's an incredibly intricate form of error-correcting code, but we're not through. The DNA is just the master record. That's the master blueprint. You need a working copy to go out on the factory floor. Call that the RNA. So the first thing, the DNA has to be transcribed to become RNA. That RNA then will be the recipe by which the proteins are manufactured, the functional machines. Going from DNA to RNA has been called in biotechnology the Crick dogma. The premise was that it could only flow from DNA to RNA to proteins. The shock throughout the biological world is to discover that you can have retroviruses. It can go the other way. It's possible for intruders of the right kind to not only screw up the RNA, but to alter the master record. The example would be on your computer if you're on the internet, that some virus gets in and doesn't just mess up your computer, it messes up your backup copies. That could be disturbing. You know, you got a virus, okay, you shut down, boot up again, your master boot record's been adjusted. That's the scary part. Something else that happens in the DNA description is worth mentioning. When the DNA is copied to RNA, a duplicate is made, but then certain portions are cut out. An editor goes by and takes certain ones. They're called introns. They're cut out. They don't know why. They conjecture that, well, these were probably things that were needed back in early evolution days. They don't need them now. Well, that's nonsense. the question is, this is the first clue in my mind, you've got a multi-level code going on here. This is very similar to what happens in the Bible with equidistant letter sequencing. Anyway, what's left, of course, is called messenger RNA. And it has essentially the same code as the DNA. There's one chemical that's switched for chemical reasons. But you can, rather than learn the words, A, U, G, C will be the codes for these four. These four codes can define any amino acids. And we're just focusing on that. If you take, with those four, you can define, not only can you define all the amino acids with redundancy, you can also have some punctuation in there, start and stop bits and so forth. Another way of representing this is a little more systematic. This is the genetic code. This is the key to it all. The code for the power stations are slightly different. There's three places where there's a change. But what really happens with the code, once you get the RNA, you've got now a copy of this DNA. The DNA has manufactured some ribosomes, which are transfer RNA. These are machines that will look at the code and put together the sequence of amino acids they reflect on. Looks for a start bit, and then it goes ahead, and depending on what code it reads, by the code I showed you, it knows how to put together a chain. When it gets to an end bit, it'll cut it off. That chain then will fold itself up into a three-dimensional robot that will do whatever it's scheduled to do. The negatively charged groups associated with positively charged groups, the hydrophobic chain stack in the center of the thing, the hydrophilic on the outside, all these things affect the final three-dimensional shape. And even there, we still are not know enough about to predict it exactly, given a chain. Let's give you just one example. Hemoglobin is one of the proteins, one of the 100,000 proteins in the body. It happens to be about 574 amino acids long. Here's the list of them. It's not important, except they have to be in a specific order. So it turns out because there are these particular numbers and these particular, you have 20 choices, you can calculate what the chance is of having that randomly. And it turns out the formula for this is a factorial formula we'll get into here. It turns out the answer is 10 to the 650th power, 10 with 650 zeros after it. And only one of those is hemoglobin. And you change just one of them, you get hemoglobinopathy, which is a disease, typically fatal. Now, this is impossible to happen by chance. There's only 10 to the 18th seconds in the history of the universe. If you tried one every second since the universe began, assuming it was 15 billion years old, as some people suggest, there's still only 10 to the 18th seconds to fool around here. You got 10 to the 650. There's only 10 to the 66th atoms in our entire galaxy. See, 10 to the 650 is a big number. There's only 10 to the 80 particles in our galaxy. In physics, they say any probability that's smaller than 10 to the minus 50th is absurd. There's a point which you've got to cut off and say it's impossible. Yes, it's technically, theoretically possible, but it's so remote as to be considered absurd that that would ever happen. That's only 10 to the 50th in physics. We're talking 10 to the 650th, which says, in effect, there's no way this could have happened by accident. It was designed, very skillfully designed. One quick look at the bacterial flagellum. I'm just going to focus on the one little part, just to give you some feeling here. This is the little wiggle on the bacteria that propels it through the water. It turns out they now know it's a motor. It's got C rings and P rings, and it's a double membrane. It has 40 different parts, any one of which would cause it not to work if it wasn't there. 40 essential parts. Design. One of the questions you ask is, is the chicken or the egg came first? No, the question is, did DNA come first or did protein come first? You see, it takes protein to make DNA. But it takes DNA to make the protein. Which came first? The answer is obvious. They both had to be created at the same time and very skillfully coordinated. It was very, very careful, consistent architecture. And by the way, thoughts, the language, is not physical in the first place. We'll come back to that at the end of the day here. The heavens do declare the glory of God. The firmament showeth his handiwork. Day to day uttereth speech, and night unto night showeth knowledge. There's no speech nor language where their voice is not heard, their lines going out through all the earth, their words to the end of the world. Very familiar passage to you, the first four verses of Psalm 19. But we always think about that, you know, of the night sky, astronomy. But notice carefully the word. They declare the speech, the knowledge, the speech, the language, the words. We're talking, that's the key. It's the thoughts expressed in language. And it's interesting, we've seen that through the telescope as we look at the night sky. We now see it through the electron microscopes as we look inside our very bodies. I've spent some time on the DNA thing because I think the language is, and the awe that we should acknowledge as we get into this technology is just staggering. And I mention it's not just an appreciation as an apologetic, so to speak, but to recognize as we intrude in this, we're intruding in a sphere that, unlike other forms of adventure, affects everybody. When a scientist gets in, starts cloning and starts mucking around in these cells, they mutate, they multiply, and they may not be controllable, and they have implications for generations. So just some summary insights as we tie up this portion of it. The origin of information cannot be explained. Darwinism cannot explain the beginning of life, or source of life, because they can't explain the origin of information. And the incomprehensible and irreducible complexity refutes design by accident or chance. And I think the choreography that we see totally destroys any random theory. That's coordinated. In fact, the real doubt that one might have is that the information is even contained in the DNA. There are scientists that believe that God has to be personally involved in every cell division. That comes from some information equations. The digital codes imply, in fact, they demand pre-planning. And no system dependent on subsystems can survive random failures without redundancy. So anyone that's had a design background, this thing just screams deliberate design. The fact that all cells derive from preceding cells, in effect, says the same thing. But now let's shift a little bit. Let's get back to, let's put yourself in the following picture. Your six-year-old, you discover from your doctor, has a rare bone marrow disease, a form of anemia. He has bleeding disorders, severe immune system problems, and is likely to die of leukemia within a year. And you put yourself in that, put yourself in those shoes. The doctor tells you there's a 90% chance of curing it through a cell transplant technique from the umbilical cord of a matched sibling. What we've got to do is get a matched sibling. How do you get a matched sibling? Well, you're going to have another baby. And the baby can be fine. We need some cells from the umbilical cord. Now, it has to be the right embryo. So we may have to take, you know, a dozen or two and screen to get the right one. Okay? What would you do? Would there be any doubt in your mind? What would you do? This is the type of problem that's confronting people today. And this is an actual case. Molly Nash was born with Fanconi anemia, destined for leukemia. The only effective treatment is to get a batch of healthy cells from a perfectly matched sibling to replace the child's faulty bone marrow cells. Each parent carried both a normal and a faulty version of the Fanconi gene, so a pregnancy has a 25% chance of affecting the child. Okay? So the technique, embryos were created by standard in vitro fertilization in a laboratory dish and tested for the presence of the disease gene. First they had to screen out the ones that already would have had it also if they go, right? Only those testing normal are then to be transferred. Only 2 of 15 tested normal. Only one was healthy enough for transfer to Lisa Nash's womb. You with me so far? And it's made the news, of course. Designer baby, save sister. The Colorado couple used genetic tests to create a test tube baby that would have the exact type of cells desperately needed to save their 6-year-old daughter. And she now has a 90% chance of being free of the marrow disease. So genetic screening is clearly going to be part of our future. But she's alive, and the family is enjoying, and of course the baby's fine too, by the way. Now there were, of course, 14 other embryos that were unnecessary to the procedure. So this is something that's coming up. You know, we read science fiction, Gattaca and others, Galactica, I guess it was, in a society where people are screened. And when they're born, they're already determined which ones are going to be eligible for engineering careers and whatever. By studying the DNA, who's really going to be the winners in the society? It doesn't take a lot of imagination to see the possible social impact of these kinds of technologies. One of the other things that we haven't gotten into is this question of differentiated cells. There's a question here. If cytokinesis results in identical cells, when mitosis takes place and cytokinesis, you have, they become two, and then the two become four, right? But something happens along the way where they start not being identical anymore. Some cells start to migrate to be bone. different kinds of tissue. And the different kinds of tissues become different kinds of organs. And as we watch this take place, it continually, more and more, specializes. What causes the cells that were originally duplicating each other identically? Who orchestrated the change? Who orchestrated it? Who said, you're going to be bone, you're going to be cortical tissue, whatever? As you watch through this, it's well that most of you are familiar how the cells emerge to be an embryo. But specialization is going on. Who's orchestrating that? I thought an identical copy of the DNA was in every cell. Who's quarterbacking what the computer engineers would call conflict resolution? So the cell that's neutral, the cell that's the beginning cell, so to speak, is called a stem cell. And out of a code of four, it can orchestrate the assembly of 20 different amino acids to create 100,000 different proteins. And think of a protein very typically as an automated robotic machine. So that's going on in the one sense. But while all this is going on, the stem cell starts differentiating itself. And some of those differentiated cells then start to become over 210 different kinds of cells, different kinds of tissues and organs, to make up the organism, the entity that we're talking about. There's about 10 to the 13th cells in total. Okay, that's the process. But there is a thing called nuclear transfer. That's where, while you still have a stem cell, you reach in there, take that nucleus out, and put a different nucleus in from some donor creature. That's called nuclear transfer. The common term is cloning, because what you do is you now start, this thing starts going down a different path, and it goes down to where you have a replica of the donor, not the cell that started it. That's what we call cloning. Big news a few years ago, clone in sheep's clothing. A special needle-making machine is what made it possible so that they could remove the nucleus, put in another one, and of course you had Dolly and her surrogate mother that did all the news from Scotland. It wasn't actually the first, there were some others, but this is the one that really hit the news. Dolly the sheep. Cloning now has become pretty common. There's cloned monkeys, cloned pigs in Japan, cloned cows of all kinds. And in fact, some of the cows are shocking scientists because they're younger than the donor, which is interesting. There's all kinds of discoveries that are contradictory about aging. It's getting very interesting. Recent discovery is that rats can, given the right circumstances, the right nutrients in cells in the laboratory, duplicate without aging forever as long as there's the necessary nutrients. That's got everybody shook up. One of the questions that needs to be answered, why and when do replicating cells no longer remain identical, is one of the questions. This gets in the whole field of genetic engineering in several ways. One is to manipulate the stems to produce certain kinds of tissues, like the bone marrow thing. But the nuclear transfer where you have cloning take place is the one that's really stirring up controversy because you end up with complete beings of some kind. This raises moral issues, ethical issues, legal issues, and I might even add theological issues to us. Can a human clone, does he have a soul? Can he receive Jesus Christ and be saved? There's going to be a lot of debates about this. Legal issues too. When does tampering with an embryo become murder? To save Molly Nash, they ended up, if you excuse the expression, aborting 14 of the 15 embryos. When they got the one they needed, they were all set. What happened to the rest of them? If they'd grown up, they would have had leukemia or Down syndrome or something. You can fill in the blank. There's different versions of the same story. Is it acceptable to clone a baby to save a child's life? These are questions. And the answers are very different if it's your child. When does human life begin? Well, it begins at birth. No. John the Baptist started his ministry when he was 9 inches long, weighed a pound and a half. He leaped in the womb, expressed joy, and was spirit-filled. How will clones impact society? If this really happens, if there's a percentage of our society that are human clones, how are they going to fit in? We find pretty trivial things to stratify our society. Color of skin. What chance is a clone going to have? Interesting. Can a human clone be saved? That's a good question. We all can have different opinions about that. I have some friends. I don't know if they're saved. I don't know how I'm going to judge my claim. Anyway, let's go. And what are the prophetic implications? We're Bible literate here. Bible has a lot to say about prophecy. How do these ideas fit in, if at all? Those are some of the questions we'll take in the next hour.
For a complete listing of materials to further enhance your personal Bible study, or to receive a free one-year subscription to Chuck Missler's monthly Christian Intelligence News Journal personal update, contact Koinonia House at 1-800-KHOUSE1. That's 1-800-KHOUSE1. Or you can write to Koinonia House at P.O. Box D, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, 83816-0347. To fax your correspondence, dial 208-773-6312.